Auto Line After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion, and by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
This is Auto Line After Hours with John McElroy and Gary Vasilash, episode 346 for September 9 of 2016, Hudson's, Diesels, and the Near Death of Detroit. Watch AutoLine After Hours live at AutoLine.tv every Thursday at 3 p.m. Eastern Time. That's 12 p.m. Pacific. You can subscribe to this podcast for free by searching for AutoLine in iTunes, Stitcher, or YouTube. Mr. Vasilash, we're back at it again.
We are. We've got another car in the studio, which is always a great thing to have.
Always a good thing. And not just any car. Of course, we don't ever have just any car, but this one's got real historical value. It's a 1952 Hudson Hornet, and we're also joined by Ed Sowers, who knows a whole lot about Hudsons and a whole lot more than that. But, Ed, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much. It's good to be here.
And it's not just a Hudson Hornet. It's a Hudson Hornet that raced.
It is indeed.
Not only that, raced in NASCAR in the early 50s,
that's
obviously.
That's right, 1952. In that season, primarily this car, later in the season, because as today, cars have a way of being demolished. And Herb Thomas's car from 1952 rolled over in South Bend in July of 52, and this was his replacement car from Hudson that he got the first part of August.
A lot of people don't know this. I certainly didn't, even as a motor racing fan, that the Hudson Hornet dominated NASCAR 51 through 54.
Yeah, 54, really. During that period, 80 wins. Herb Thomas with 39 wins out of 139 entries. That's a 28% win ratio.
Which is a very good percentage, yeah. Winning percentage.
And if you look at his entire career, he was a 21%, which still holds the record of any other NASCAR driver today. Hmm. So a 60-year-old record, part of it through this car.
Well, I think another interesting thing that I learned about this was this is Labor Day week. And as you recall growing up here, that Labor Day was always the last day of the Michigan State Fair, the state fairgrounds over on 8 Mile and Woodward, mm-hmm. which I think is now a Walmart or something. And
they're developing the property.
Right? The whole property is gone, but that... These cars used to race the Michigan State Fairgrounds.
Yeah, I know in 51 and 52 at least, certainly those 2 years, certainly a strong record of NASCAR being there. So 51, 52, the race was early in 52. So this car would not have been on the track. It would have been the previous mm-hmm. car. But I think that race was ran in June of 52. Mm. So... But, yeah, NASCAR, you know, Detroit had a big part in that start and pretty good attendance and good races.
So were these dirt tracks back in the day?
Yeah, pretty much dirt track. There were very little asphalt. Of course, the beach race, Daytona.
Mm-hmm. Right out on the sand.
Was there half sand, half asphalt. So, you know, a little bit of everything. Mm-hmm. And if you watch some of the old video, it was just... treacherous and tough to get around. And although Hudson may not have had the more horsepower, it had the lowest center of gravity with its step-down design and the frame built into the car.
So it was a unibody.
Unibody
not,
car.
Not body on frame.
Right. Beginning of the unibody.
So the unibody is what allowed them to lower
right,
it?
Right. Huh. So lower center of gravity, able to corner, that more so than its power. Because other people are running V8s and a lot of horsepower.
And this is an inline six.
It's right? An inline six.
What's the displacement, do you know?
308 cubic inches.
That's a big six.
And, the first 51 that would have run would have been 145 horsepower. Mm-hmm. By the time they were running in 53 and 54, the two carburetor system had been added. A larger race engine, larger displacement was running. That got up to a little over 200 horsepower.
Mm-hmm. What else made it good? I mean, what other aspects made this car so dominant?
Well, you know, Hudson always had durability, so everything in its suspension was positive and helped toward that. It was a strong engine. It, you know, that inline six they used forever. So just that helped it hang together.
The other thing that's interesting was, you know, today you've got Ford, Chevrolet, and Toyota in NASCAR. That's it. But back when this car was running, everybody ran a car, right? I mean,
Hudson, Oldsmobile, Chrysler, Plymouth, Buick, Cadillac, DeSoto, Ford, Kaiser, Mercury, Nash, Packard, Pontiac, Studebaker, and Willys.
Yeah. Nash,
Cadillac.
I mean, this just seems crazy, doesn't it?
Yeah. You know, a Nash, you know, you think of Hudson being odd enough, but a Nash and then Hudson to have that many wins, it just must have been an incredible time for the dealers to see that. It was promoted beyond belief.
But you know, everybody got into racing, especially back then, because win on Sunday, sell on Monday. But Hudson went out of business, around 1954? So it doesn't seem like all these wins really translated into sales.
Not really. I mean, they merged in May of 54 with Nash, formed American Motors. You know, it was the way of all independents during that period of time. You know, it's a totally different story. But, racing wasn't enough, right?
Yeah.
To really do it or make the sales.
Well, and again, for Detroiters who remember things from back in the day, the famous J.L. Hudson store that was in downtown, right, which eventually, I think, merged with Target, and then just one thing led to another and ceased to exist. J.L. Hudson, that was the...
It started in 1909, and he's the one that bought the original engines for the original cars and made that investment and became his namesake.
Right.
So that's where the name came from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah, Hudson was a fairly well-known car company, like you said, 1909 till about 1954.
Right.
But what I'm intrigued, let's go back to the NASCAR part of it, too, because, you know, I always grew up thinking NASCAR started down south. Mm-hmm. And it did, obviously, you know. But I always thought all the early races were in the Carolinas, you know, Kentucky, Tennessee, that whole area, Georgia even. Yeah. I had no idea that the race up here in Detroit was really big deal with, as you mentioned, it had pretty good turnout.
Right.
Spectator
Detroit,
wise.
Toledo, South Bend, you know, all those things within our grasp here. And you just don't think about that. Yeah. You're right. You think
Grand Rapids had a race.
Yeah, exactly, Grand Rapids.
Monroe, Michigan had a race.
Mm-hmm. And these were all NASCAR races?
Yeah. Right.
Really?
Yeah, you just don't think. You think it's all Southern. You're right. It's really quite different.
You were mentioning earlier that in order for the car to run, it had to have parts that people could order out of a catalog. So stock cars back then were truly stock cars.
Yes, they got the name stock for a reason. Yeah, there was a list of a page of things you could do, and basically that came down to remove the gas tank door for easier filling.
Mm-hmm.
You could put an elastic strap over the hood so that you didn't have to go through any elaborate system of unleashing the hood in case you needed in there. I mean, you had to run the same size tires that came on the car. You could remove the back seat. I'm assuming that's when the car rolled over, you didn't have to worry about it hitting your head. But there were, you know, a few things like that safety issues that made sense. A seat belt, of course. But everything else you had to be able to get at your local Hudson dealership.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, we got a shot of the seat belts there right now. Now, these aren't, you know, these are like racing belts.
Right.
And it's only a lap belt, though, no shoulder
or anything
like that.
Right? Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you had to put in the seat belts, or was that obvious?
Yeah, you had to.
Okay.
It was a dangerous sport. I mean,
yeah, even that.
That seat just sits in there, you know. It's not like today's seats.
So back in the day, I mean, when all of these various types of vehicles were being raised, the Pontiacs and the Oldsmobiles and the Cadillacs, I mean, could it have been that John owned a Cadillac and he just decided, you know what, I'm going to enter that race?
Probably could have. He would try to get a sponsor here or there.
Right, but I mean,
But
he could have just basically just entered his daily driver car.
Yeah, I don't know that for a fact.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not that much of an authority on what that would have been look like. It appears to be the same group of people in each of those races. They did the same point standing that we do today. Herb Thomas, the driver of this car, won that circuit in 51. He was second in 52. He won again in 53. He was second in 54. So when you think about this guy, he was one of NASCAR's first superstars.
No kidding.
Yeah, he took a beating in these cars.
I can imagine. Now, you say this is the last Hudson Hornet race car in existence.
Yeah, that's we can't find another, so we believe this is it. We've got documentation from the factory on this car and this serial number, and the dates match up with when he got the car after the South Bend accident. So what Hudson did was created a note, a kind of a promissory note with their drivers, and I have archives from other drivers like Marshall Teague and some of the other cars that this was done. So it's not just a Herb Thomas deal, but they'd prepare a note and say, here's your car, and the car is $2,200 or whatever it is, so sign a note, show you got it, and then they immediately stamp the note canceled. So in other words, here it is, recognize you're getting it, but you don't have to pay for it. And there's a long line of verbiage in the note that said, you know, you'll return the car in great shape, and, you know, it'll be, you know, just like it was when it left, with an asterisk, except for any damage due to racing.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's on all these promissory notes from all the drivers of the 50s. So it was kind of like a, you know, it was something to laugh at, really. And yeah. So we have that note for this car.
Where'd you find the car?
Jack Miller, who ran Hudson dealership in Ypsilanti, found the car down south, I believe in Georgia, in the 80s. He used to sell parts to people all over the country for Hudsons. And somebody wrote and said, I need axle bearings. So he sent axle bearings, and it didn't fit. And so, you know, Jack begins to go, well, something's wrong here. You know, all Hudsons are the same. Well, except those which might have been police use, taxi use, or race cars. And so it didn't take long for Jack to figure out that this was a race car, and then beginning to check serial numbers and everything with the note documentation, realized that it was the real deal. So he brought it after about, I think, a 6 or 7 year exchange to get it bought, brought it back to Ypsilanti and had a restoration done several years ago. And it's resided at the Ypsi Museum.
So tell us about the Hudson
dealership
is now...
Okay. Hudson dealership went in there in 1932. Millers ran it through the merger and through American Motors into 58, 59, that vintage. And when they stopped selling Hudsons, they just continued to sell used cars out of the building. And Jack continued to focus on selling Hudsons. And so a lot of parts gathered up there, a lot of things gathered, and Jack just eventually kind of turned it into a museum kind of thing. And then the community got behind it and said, well, there were other things built here too, like Tuckers and Corvairs, and being a Hudson guy, I'm going to leave somebody out. But hydromatic transmissions were built in Ypsi. So why don't we build a museum that is all things Ypsilanti? And so the Hudson garage anchors that. Although they weren't built there, it was the last dealership, fairly close to Detroit, so that made sense. So it anchors it, and then additional buildings have been added for these other displays. 3 years ago, the National Hudson Club said, we need a place for our national museum, and Ypsilanti seemed to be the right place for that. Ed Sauer seemed to be the right guy to help put that together. So I've been working as a director of the Hudson display now for the last 3 years. But it is the National Hudson Museum resides within the Ypsilanti Auto Heritage Museum. And so it's a unique partnership.
Yeah, no kidding. So what's your attraction to Hudson? What got you into it?
My grandfather bought one new in 1940, and that's all the family drove then until 1973. And then, so I went to high school in a Hudson. I went to college in a Hudson.
Everybody must have said, what the hell is that?
My sister, who wanted to get a date, I remember her telling my dad, can't we just buy a Buick? You know, she thought maybe something a little more up to date would be nice. But, yeah, you know, it was unique and different. They weren't on the road anymore mm-hmm. in the late 60s and 70s. But my dad was a farmer by nature and a collector by nature, and collected about 150 of these things over his lifetime. Many of them became parts cars. But I have three brothers, and we all jumped in and keep the dream alive, mm-hmm. as crazy as it is.
So if somebody's rolling through Ypsilanti and they want to see the museum, it's open to the public.
Go to 100 right? East Cross Street, open from noon till 4 mm-hmm. each day. And, yeah, you can see the Hudson display. We start with a 1909 Hudson and go up through 1957. And, of course, the NASCAR is there as well. And then a nice display of Kaisers, a Tucker display there, Corvairs, mm-hmm. and hydromatic transmission display, which kind of shows from the beginning to the end. And I think, well, what a strange thing. But there are a lot of people in this area that work there.
Sure. My dad worked there.
And they like to go back and, you know.
Hey, I got one more for you, if you can find it. That's where GM started building the Wankel engine.
Okay.
And, they actually started building units until they shut the whole program down. But that was built at the hydromatic plant.
Yeah. So, great museum. A lot of neat history there.
So where were Hudsons built? Were they built in Detroit?
They were built in Detroit. The main plant was Jefferson and Connor. That's the main across from what's currently a Chrysler.
Yeah, Jefferson factory. North.
Yeah.
So it was right across the same area.
It was right across the street. Yeah.
Wow. Where they make the Grand Cherokee today.
Right.
Yeah.
So. Which is the only car plant still in Detroit, right?
That's correct. Yeah. That is correct. I mean, well, the Viper plant is still in Detroit.
Connor Avenue.
And that's Connor Avenue, right.
But that's going down.
It's going to shut down.
Right.
That's right.
Hmm. So.
And just in case everyone who might be listening to the podcast version of this is trying to picture what the heck does a Hudson Hornet look like, I've got a model here of the car from the movie's car, the Pixar animated movie. Yeah. And Paul Newman played the voice role right. of the character Doc, and that was a Hudson Hornet.
Came out in 2006. Huh. It was a $20 billion movie.
Uh-huh.
And, it tells the story of this famous race car driver, the new hotshot driver and the old driver. And certainly it's picking up the theme from Herb Thomas of winning and losing and winning and losing and understanding that you need to still go on. And, you don't need to be a hotshot about it. So, mm-hmm. A lot of that lessons you learn from the Hudson Hornet we see again in the movie, the Pixar movie. Hudson had its, big heyday in the 50s, and in 06 when the movie came out again, every kid went to see it. I remember my boys and me going, and now with Cars 1, 2, and 3, mm-hmm. The world pretty much knows what a Hudson Hornet is.
Any more credibility for your sister is that Paul Newman played?
She would still like to have a Buick, I think.
Hey, we've got a phone call question for you here. Okay. Carmen, let's bring that in.
This is Clem Zorowski in Delmont, Pennsylvania. Many years ago, I was at my girlfriend's dad's place, and he was under the car doing something, and I asked him, "What are you doing?" And he says, "I'm changing the oil in the clutch." At that time, he had a Hudson, I'm not sure what model. I said, "Oh, yeah, right, changing oil in the clutch." Many years later, I found out that Hudson's had that cork clutch that had to be lubricated. My question is, why did they have that type of clutch instead of the standard dry clutch? Thank you.
Thanks for that question, Clem.
Yeah,
good one.
Great question. If you go to the museum, there's a display, a cutaway of the Hudson clutch because it's so unique and different. Rolls-Royce used that system. Hudson used that system. It's the smoothest clutch you'll ever find, and durable, lasting. Still today, people talk on the internet about, I want to change my wet clutch to a dry clutch, and all of us who've lived with them all our lives say, why would you ever want to do that? I mean, very durable. It took a little maintenance, but smooth, as you could get.
It's interesting that you say that because there's a big argument today with dual clutch transmissions, DCTs. And some of the car companies, I won't pick on anybody right by name, but have tried to go with the dry clutch way. And the consumer complaints about it are humongous. Mm-hmm. And they're trying to cut cost, right?
Right.
But what the people who make those things tell me, like BorgWarner, is that you got to go with a wet clutch if you want to go with the DCT and get smooth shifts. So there you go. Even today, it's relevant. Armand also wrote in, were there any creative, quote-unquote, creative tricks Hudson used to gain an illegal edge over the competition?
Oh, certainly not my beloved Hudson, right? How could that happen? Certainly in the day, there were mechanics that would try to do things internally, change bore, change valve sizes, do all those kind of things. Eventually, Hudson just kind of did all those things and put out what they called a 7X engine. That was the kind of the name of the racing engine. But that didn't come out till 53. So Hudson kind of did that, made it severe usage so the drivers could use it. But, you know, one of the famous mechanics, Smokey Kunick, did a lot of Hudson repair, a lot of Hudson work. And if you check him out on the Internet, you can hear a lot of his stories about what he did. But just like modern-day NASCAR, at the end of the race, they had the right to tear it down if they wanted to. So you had to be very, very careful about that.
Well, you had to be careful. You had to be creative is what the real word is. Because you know the old saying in NASCAR, it ain't cheating if you didn't get caught. So everybody tried to bend the rules. That's part of motor racing.
And that day was pretty much about the engine. You know, what hung together underneath was one thing, but how you got more power out of the engine.
So the 7X engine was an engine that was ostensibly available to people to put in their...
You order it through the dealership for severe usage.
Yes, severe usage.
And the engines.
And the driving car on dirt tracks.
That's severe, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Well, real good. Ed Sowers, thanks so much for stopping by, especially for bringing this fabulous Hudson Hornet along with you. It's really unique to have something like this in the studio.
Enjoyed my time with you today.
Beautiful.
Thank you.
Real good. We're going to take a quick commercial break right now. We're going to come back. We got a lot more to talk about of what's going on in this automotive industry. Well, we're back. We're going through a bit of a change here. We're bringing a couple of people on. Is Michelle out there?
Yeah, she'll be right out of
here. Oh, okay. So that voice you just heard, I think you might have just heard it, Mike Austin, the editor-in-chief of Autoblog. I got the title right? Come on
hey,
in.
Michelle.
Come on in, Michelle. Katie will put a microphone on you. No, you can keep that beautiful necklace on. So... a lot of news going on.
You're just saying there's no news.
All right. So, okay. So we got Michelle Krebs here.
Yeah.
And she's a movie star.
She's a movie star.
She's a movie star.
Movie, you know.
What was your first movie?
Revenge of the Electric Car.
Yeah.
I was gonna
go.
Oh.
But this.
That opened at Tribeca.
This was your starring role, though, I think.
Oh, no. That one was.
You're the first person on camera
in
this movie.
Well, this is true.
And, in fact, you have the phrase that...
Made the movie. Yeah. Well, then Steve Miller said it later.
I know.
Now the audience is saying, what the hell are they? Okay, so there's a documentary just coming out called Live Another Day.
Yes.
That's all about the big collapse, especially in Detroit in 2008, 2009, and the subsequent bailouts and all that. So now everybody's sort of caught up to speed.
Right.
And this documentary opens up with Michelle sitting in front of a Ford GT talking all about the big collapse.
Yes, yes. And my job in that film was to kind of set the scene. You know, what was it like? What signs did we see? What did it feel like in Detroit when that all was happening?
And then you said we get up every day and try to...
Well, we didn't know if we would live another day in the industry.
Mm-hmm.
Hence the title of the documentary, Live Another Day, which is also a James Bond
film. Yes, it is.
Die Another Day.
Oh, Die Another Day. Okay.
Yeah. But so the movie is actually going to open
September 16th
across this great land, and but we got to see it last night, and we got to see Michelle, who was there, and
yes.
So how did you like the movie that you are such an integral part of?
I was mixed about it because it really first of all it felt like outsiders coming in and didn't understand the industry necessarily. It definitely had a clear point of view that I don't necessarily fully agree with.
Which you think is... See, I don't think it has a good, clear point of view, but...
Well, I thought an immense amount of the blame was laid on the union.
Yes.
And there was blame to go all around. I mean, I think management got off the hook for decisions about product, you know, not answering when the Japanese came into the market. There were just a lot of things. Those of us who have covered this know that. The other thing that bothered me about the film is that this, and I'm afraid the public will view it this way, that this was a Detroit story, that this was an auto story. We all know what was going to happen. If GM and Chrysler had been let go, it would have had devastating effects on the whole economy. And I don't think Americans understand how important the auto industry is to the economy. Mm-hmm. I pulled out today the Center for Automotive Research study on what would happen. I mean, the worst case scenario was like every state was going to lose money. You'd lose tax money. It was like over a million people would be laid off from, mm-hmm. from these. It would have sent the country into a depression. And I think that is not clear in the movie.
Well, at the very end of the movie, that Steve Rattner, who had headed the task force on the auto industry,
totally got fired.
Right.
basically said this was the cheapest jobs program this country has ever had.
True, but did you sense that it got that point across that this was?
No, because then right after that, they basically talked about how he was indicted for
Right. Securities fraud.
Yeah.
Right.
How did you, John, you saw the movie. What did you think?
Well, number one, I thought it was too long. Mm-hmm. You know, I'm a policy wonk and this kind of stuff. More detail, better. I think the two guys they did a yeoman's job. The amount mm-hmm. of editing that went into this was incredible. But it's almost 2 hours long. I think if they would go back in, re-edit it, get it down to about an hour, or maybe 52 minutes, then you could put it on television, too, because I don't see this thing working in movie theaters. I think it's ideal for television. Mm-hmm. But I think if they chopped it down to the best of the best, they'd have one hot documentary yeah. on their hands.
Right.
There's parts of it that are excellent, but, man, it's long. And, you know,
and a lot of talking heads and just sitting there.
Right.
So you're just
right. So they didn't, you know, not, you know, we're in the media, right?
Mm-hmm.
And,
mm-hmm.
So to me, when you start to tell a story, you say, look, here's the overall view. Here's a couple of key points I'm going to make along the way. Now you start telling it. Now people are sort of on board with you, whereas this was just interview after interview mm-hmm. after interview after, you know, and they did take some nice breaks. They had some nice music and car shots of yore and all that. But, man, I think another 6 months in the editing room and they would have won. Dynamite documentary.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, see, when I agree that they really piled on the union quite a bit, mm-hmm. and they sort of let management off the hook. But then I sort of got this sense that they were just like very critical of the politicians who had to make the decisions
right.
regarding what we're going to do in terms of the auto
right.
industry and like they didn't know what the hell they're doing, and they only looked at it from a financial perspective. But I was sitting there thinking, wait a minute, aren't they asking for $30 billion? Isn't that money? Isn't that financial? Isn't the problem a financial problem?
Yeah.
Doesn't that have to be addressed? I mean, so you know, how is this bad? I mean, it's yeah. like, you know, they're you know, and it reminded me of the TV show MASH, you know, when they talk about how they're, you know, they're doing meatball surgery because, mm. you know, they had to do this fast. And maybe,
totally.
And maybe they didn't understand all the nuances. And, mm-hmm. and you know, and I get that. But, I mean, they had to do something. And as
right.
you say, the Center for Automotive Research, you know, shows that.
And the longer the time went on, the more the damage. I mean, that,
right.
that was clear. We all knew that,
yeah.
you know.
No, I think in retrospect, the bailout was brilliant.
Yes.
I mean, because of what you're talking about here, everything had to be done in a matter of months.
Right.
And largely by people who have no clue what the industry is mm-hmm. about or how complex it can be. And look, here we are, 8 years later, GM Ford, now FCA,
mm-hmm.
you know, rip-roaring along, car sales through the roof, profits
probably
very
the
solid.
Best financial health they've been in.
Yeah, so, I mean, did it work? You bet it worked.
Mm-hmm. Did you get a chance to see it, Mike? Or...
No, I haven't seen it, but it does kind of remind me, you know, like I feel like we have a short memory. This was not that long ago, and it was really traumatic for the whole industry. And it was this thing, you know, we're saying... You had all these politicians and all these talking heads and all this outside media who didn't know anything about the car business, but you also had the car business failing. So everyone from the outside is looking at it and saying, well, these guys clearly don't know how to run the company either. And I think, you know, like you said, they've turned around. I don't know if they've learned all the lessons.
No, probably.
But it was, you know, triage. It was like, we have to save the patient no matter what. And you know, that's, I think, just sort of remembering that mentality. You know, looking back, I think, we get a lot of rhetoric on the site about people saying, oh, you know, it's a government bailout, or you know, this was bad, or we should have let them fail. And you forget, you know, all of the lasting impact. Like any city that had one supplier factory, you know, like that city
or a dealer
would get, or a dealer, you know, like small towns could get wiped out.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. And I just don't think that that was what didn't really come across, the urgency of it and the hugeness.
Panic.
Yeah,
the panic that was going on at the time.
I mean, it was hard to watch it again. It's like, oh, God, I don't want to relive that time.
No, Michelle, that's funny you say that. That was my same reaction. I don't want to bring back those memories, those feelings.
And that's one of the things that I was supposed to talk about in the film is, like, what did it feel like? Well, it was surreal. Mm-hmm. I mean, literally every day another shoe would drop in those, oh, those earrings and the, you know, just being on edge. And, you know, we all work for companies that rely on the auto companies. At the time I worked for Edmunds, we didn't know if we'd get paid, you know, and we were going to be in business. So, oh, wow, it was, I don't think you could get across what it really felt like.
See, what surprised me a little bit is I think Bob Nardelli came out better in that movie.
Yes, I would say so, too.
And I mean, I think that you know, you listen to him talk, and it's just like, wow.
Yeah, well, he was also rewriting history, I remember
too.
It.
Well, there was that, but I mean, and I think if there was a villain, I mean, I think it was Sergio came out as being a villain in this whole thing.
Well, that was so funny. That was, you know what, actually, let's come back to that.
Okay.
We got to take a quick commercial break, or a quick break right here, and we'll pick up on that thought again. So, Carmen, let's go to that break right now.
There's only one talk show that covers the issues and executives that drive the auto industry. Turn to AutoLine This Week, every Friday at AutoLine.tv or on your local PBS stations across America. AutoLine This Week. You can't get more inside the industry.
Okay, we're back. We had left off of them making Sergio Marchionne look like a carpetbagger who had just swept in and picked.
And like he knew that Fiat was going to go down the tube and he was, you know, taking on Chrysler to save Fiat. That was that kind of.
And
he didn't know that.
No, he didn't know, not at the time. But Nardelli, Bob Nardelli, mm-hmm. former CEO of Chrysler, Tom Lasorda, former CEO mm-hmm. of Chrysler, had their own plan.
Right.
And the movie kind of makes it look like, hey, maybe they would have pulled it off. I don't think they had a chance in hell of doing that.
They didn't have the money to do it. You know, there's no way.
Yeah. And Tom Lasorda, I thought, you know, former president, then CEO of Chrysler, I thought he came off great. I just thought that he seemed to be more. And he has that one scene where he says, well, you know what? If people want to buy or drive Rams, they probably don't want to drive Fiat 500s.
Right.
I mean, and how true has that proven to be, right?
Yes.
I mean, it's just like, I mean, Mike, what do you think? I mean, is Fiat, the Fiat part of FCA, is that sustainable in the U.S. market?
I don't
think so. I mean, as a small niche player, but no, not really. I mean, look at it now. You have Jeep and Ram propping up the whole company, but even right away, you know, it was Fiat coming in to save the company, and then all of a sudden, the Chrysler half is propping up Fiat as the European market tanks. So,
I don't think anybody knew that was
right. No,
the movie makes it look like, oh, that's why he was doing it, but that was.
But really the argument was basically that Sergio said, okay, I've got this small car technology, and I've got this multi-air engine technology, and it will cost $4 billion for Chrysler to develop it itself. And the guys in Washington are going, you're probably right. That's $4 billion. And, yeah, that's your contribution to the whole thing. And now the Fiat 500 sales are what?
Like nowhere's available.
Right.
Terrible. And if you look at the highest levels of inventory, it's the 3500 product.
And we're talking like three-digit inventory days
exactly.
level.
In the hundreds.
And what's using the multi-air?
The 500, I think all of the Fiats, and including the Spider. And then a Dart,
the former Dart.
Well, and that was the other
no,
interesting thing
Dart,
in the movie. They show the factory. Well, it was the Dart factory, I believe it was, or 200.
It was a 200 factory where they're
Sterling Heights.
That's going away.
Yeah.
So that didn't work out.
Isn't it in the fire engine in the Jeep Renegade?
Yeah, because that's the Fiat platform. It's made in Italy.
So that's 500X.
Yes. And then does anyone remember when, like, you know, during the time, you know, around then, Chrysler made all of those EV prototypes to say, you know, sort of to court the government and say, look, we're doing things that are friendly to all these government agendas.
Mm-hmm. Losing, what did Marchione said, losing $5,000 on every single one?
Oh, no, no. I think you're talking about even before that.
Before, No,
Nardelli did it. He had like some secret battery that GE was working on that they were going to, it was a bunch
quite a secret.
What a smokescreen.
They're keeping it secret now.
Yeah, yeah.
It never went anywhere. Hey, speaking of which, and maybe this is a great segue, speaking of FCA, what do you guys make of Reed Bigland and now the SEC, Securities and Exchange Commission, and the Department of Justice maybe coming down on these guys? Michelle, let's start with you.
Well, I don't know what to make of that, but, you know, Fiat Chrysler sales have always been interesting. You know, we do forecasting, and they always come in above, a little above the forecast, and so we've always had this kind of Fiat Chrysler factor that we factor in, and so, you know, I don't know how that's going to turn out.
Mike, your thoughts?
You know, it's there was a little bit of smoke, and it just keeps piling up. Mm-hmm. You know, they even walked back like a week or two ago, you know, clarifying what they mean their sales to be monthly. And it clearly wasn't enough. It was, you know, there's something there, I think.
Well, what I find interesting is the numbers involved are very little. What is it, Gary? You probably got a 3,500 cars or 4,500 cars over like an 8-year period out of 7.7 million vehicles. There's less than 5,000 cheater sales
involved.
Well,
and some of our analysis shows some of that's. There's something with fleet sales that are, when we look at it, it's not around the retail sales. It's somewhere in the fleet sales.
Oh, interesting. So well, maybe there's more to this story.
There's always been games played with fleet sales.
So when FCA earlier in the summer decided that they would adjust the way they counted cars because there was some issue regarding that, and so they went back in time. And to your point, John, about the small number. So this is now, this is according to FCA US LLC, they said the maximum numerical reduction from previously reported data was 770 units, 0.5% of the month's volume in May 2015, and the maximum numerical addition to previously reported data was 437 units, 0.4% in September 14th. So they're basically saying it was basically nothing. I mean, it was just almost a wash that, you know, they weren't.
Except that, I mean, I think what brought it to a head is the dealers in, I think, Illinois coming after Fiat Chrysler.
Suing them.
Yes. Yeah,
suing them, saying, hey, you guys made us cheat.
Right.
Well, it was like you guys made us sell cars so we could get the money from the corporation for selling the cars. So we had to do things to sell the cars that we perhaps should not have done.
And it's not necessarily the numbers. It's just the mindset, right? You know, you're doing something. It's a publicly traded company, and that's, you know, potential fraud if you're reporting something is sold that isn't really sold, or, you know, you're doing these
sold
weird
dealer. Or you take it back.
Here's how it happened, or at least this is what the SEC and the DOJ is going after, is that Chrysler uses what they call a stair-step sales incentive for dealers.
Every company
does. So if you sell this many, you get a kickback from the company. Right. If you sell that many, you get a bigger kickback. Mm-hmm. And if you sell this number, you get a whopping amount of money. And it's all to...
We'll take you to Paris.
It's to incentivize dealers to do this thing.
And dealers don't particularly like it.
No, they hate it. So one of the they got enough pressure. They've already bought these cars. They're under enormous pressure to sell them. They don't need somebody breathing down their back mm-hmm. say, sell more. So what they did is, to cheat the numbers a little bit, is you would report a car is sold, and then, to use the industry jargon, you would unwind the sale.
Yeah.
And that's not uncommon either. Mm-hmm. So if somebody comes in, they want to buy a car, and then all of a sudden, and you go through all the paperwork, and the bank says, guess what, we're not going to give you the money. Mm-hmm. So you unwind that sale, and you put the car back on the lot. What Chrysler was doing was there was no legitimate person. They would just report it sold.
And then unwind.
They would report those sales. They would unwind the sale. And now what they were, instead of putting it back on the lot and starting all over, they would sell it as a used car. And actually, under Bigland, who's also the president of FCA Canada, that's where they really started honing this process. So anyway, Chrysler comes out and brags. We've had in their SEC filings, in their annual report, they're now bragging to shareholders and other potential investors, 75 months of unbroken mm-hmm. sales increases. This is why the SEC is getting involved. And the other thing that's very interesting, and this is why Reid Biglin could be in big trouble as the head of sales, is the Department of Justice is now saying, hey, wait a minute, we go after all these corporations and they just pay the fine and whatever. There's no real consequences. So we, the DOJ, are not going to change the way we do. We're going after the executives that did it. And that's why Reid Biglin could be in big trouble. And what that tells me is, man, if I'm a Volkswagen executive.
Yes, indeed.
What the hell is going to happen?
Time to
now?
Go work at a bank where you can just, you know, right. avoid any responsibility.
I'd go hide because I think the DOJ is going to go after VW executives.
So with the sales, though, this is the kind of thing at the end of the year, especially when people are like vying for sales crowns. There's always kind of whispers from, you know, one company saying, well, these guys, those aren't real sales or they're, mm-hmm. they're counting dealer deliveries. Like, Michelle, is this something that other companies do that you think?
I don't know to what extent, but you certainly see a lot of game playing, and December's a huge month for that. And it's stupid because really, what does a consumer care if, you know, BMW gets the luxury sales crown or Mercedes? Do I buy a BMW because they sold more cars than anybody else? It is the wrong race. And, you know, they might the right race is to go for profit per vehicle. Sell less vehicles, make more profits, you know, instead of playing these games of incentives. We know where that goes.
But I'll bet you, I don't know this for a fact, but I will bet you.
Bonuses are based.
Bonuses, yes. Exactly. You are incentivized as an executive. If you're at BMW to kick Mercedes
well, the
in the teeth.
To incentivize on.
I totally agree. Completely agree. Because all you do, you know this better than I do, you pull sales forward. So you have a great December, and then you kill sales in January, maybe even February.
But I get constantly media calls when the quarterly numbers come out as, oh, Volkswagen's worldwide is ahead of Toyota. I'm like, wrong race. You can buy sales. You can buy market share just with incentives. And that's a really bad race to be in.
Right back to 2008.
Exactly.
There you go. It all comes full circle.
Exactly.
Okay, we got to take another commercial break. We got a lot of other topics because there really is news this week, you guys. But anyway, Carmen, let's take that break and give a shout out to our friends at Lear.
Lear Kinexus offers a parental controls application with geofencing that sends notifications regarding driving behavior and location, including curfew alerts, acceleration alerts, and speed alerts, all delivered to a smartphone application that includes vehicle location, driver notifications, and a report card of driving history, including notifications when predefined geographic boundaries are crossed. For more information, visit Lear.com.
Glad I'm not a teenager.
Yeah, all this monitoring
no.
stuff. So, Gary, you had some things on your list you wanted to get into.
Yeah, well, one of them is I saw Reuters reported this week that Renault is saying that it expects diesels to disappear from most of its European cars in the not-too-distant future. And Car and Driver reported that the head of Volkswagen in the United States basically said, you know, this pushing of diesels in the United States, it's over. It's done.
What do you think, so, Mike?
You know, meanwhile, Jaguar, you know, renewed their commitment to diesel, possibly because they have an investment in the new engine. But, yeah, I think even with VW, you go back to CES, which was, you know, right around the head of the diesel scandal. Everything since CES and on their CES booth has been all electric. They've been switching over. You know, I think it's probably real. And you think it's not just the scandal. There's also the data in Europe about particulate emissions and, you know, dealing with public health. And, you know, Europe especially is very active in terms of like government action on things like air quality and government health, public health. So I see it. I think the tide in terms of public opinion is probably going to kill diesel. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. And California doesn't have, you know, the strict emissions there. And
well, you know, what I see is that it's expensive to emissionize a diesel.
Right.
And I think we've hit the crossover point where a 48-volt mild hybrid that's going to give you near diesel-like fuel economy mm-hmm. is cheaper than going with a diesel.
Yeah, and you have family cars. I mean, you know, going back to Jaguar, you have, like, those luxury cars get into the 40 miles per gallon in the diesels, and they don't, you know, you can't do that with the gas version. But large sedans like the Accord and the Altima and the Malibu, all of those family sedans that are about the same car size as those luxury cars are getting up into 40 miles per gallon. You're not getting the advantage that you used to have. to your point, John.
And isn't the engine architecture that Jaguar is using, it's like the Ingenium engine or something like that, that it's basically a gasoline or diesel. So, I mean, the architecture is basically the same. So they're like, ah, what the hell? We got this thing. Let's just use it. But, yeah, I mean, in the Reuters report, I mean, they're saying that in road tests on almost 100 vehicles ordered by French Commission on diesel emissions, Renault and Nissan cars produce more than 8 times the regulatory NOx limit on average, with most of their Euro 6 models closer to 10 times.
But that's all legal.
The road. Yeah.
This is the joke about European emission standards, is they have very tough standards and the easiest tests in the world.
Yeah.
And so when they say, oh, it's 10 times the legal limit, well, they're comparing a in-lab test versus out on the open road. And European emission regulations, I'm not going to say that they let you do anything that you want out on the open road, but it doesn't have to be like the lab test.
Mm-hmm.
Contrast that to the U.S., where the lab tests are very much trying to mimic the open road. Mm-hmm. Now, there's issues with the EPA test and whatnot, too. But the irony is that an American car of similar size and displacement is almost without doubt far cleaner than its European version.
Mm-hmm. So, Mike, to your point of Volkswagen positioning itself in terms of being more and more electric, so they announced this week that they're going to have a joint venture company with a Chinese company, which I'm going to screw up when I try to say it, Zhanghuai Automobile Company. And what I thought was interesting in this announcement is that they're saying that they're going to explore all options on how to concentrate our resources, including existing and future model platforms. I mean, so it almost sounds like Volkswagen is saying, we're going to do whatever it takes to work with these guys to make EVs in China. Do you see that as being a real possibility?
I mean, there's two pieces of that. One is, to sell in China, you basically have to produce in China, which means you have to partner with a Chinese company and potentially give up a bunch of intellectual property. But, you know, like, that's the way to sell cars in China. It's not really an import-friendly market. But the other piece is, there are all these Chinese companies with tons of money. So if you want to get, you know, especially in China, where the market hasn't matured to, you know, really go after, like, quality and reliability, there's a lot of, you know, there's a lot of vehicles out there and of varying degrees of quality. So, you know, in a market that reacts so fastly with so much money, I think it's probably a China play. But again, you're building, you could also use that as a test bed for other markets. You're like, hey, we've been producing this for 3 or 4 years. We know all the problems. We can bring it over to Europe or the U.S. where the customer is a little more careful about what they buy and what they expect.
Mm-hmm. And Volkswagen's so, you know, big in China, and the government wants to move towards electric. So it kind of makes sense in that. Whether it's
Yeah, but what I'm curious is, they've got two other partners. Volkswagen has two other partners already in China, right? FAW, First Auto Works, and what's the other one? SAIC, I think? Shanghai Automotive Industry.
Everybody works with SAIC.
Yeah. Why didn't they do it with those guys?
But maybe does this company have technology? That's the only thing I was thinking.
Well, see, the thing, so what I thought was sort of interesting was that basically, so it says JACs, what's their acronym, rather than trying to say that thing that I screwed up before. Main products include heavy-duty and light and miniature trucks.
Yeah. They're the guys who tried to rip off the copy of the Ford F-150, JAC.
So I guess they don't have technology, huh?
I don't think they do.
I think maybe, to Mike's point, they might have money.
Or is this a play into the commercial truck market with electric?
That's what it would possibly seem. And we talked few months maybe now on the show about when Volkswagen came out and announced that they're going to have the 30 EVs coming. Mm-hmm. And we were saying, well, is this going to be mild hybrids? And
electrified. EV.
And in this announcement this week, it says more than 30 new purely battery-powered electric vehicles over the next 10 years. So purely battery-powered electric vehicles.
So, I mean, are they counting, you know, Golf GTI, Golf Wagon, Golf as separate models?
But as e-Golf, though? I mean, but electric versions of those, rather than having some sort of a mild hybrid, or as the Valeo car we had in here a couple of weeks ago?
Oh, yeah, the MKZ.
Yeah, that had...
With the 48-volt system.
Right.
Sometimes I think these announcements go out and there's some other purpose for putting them out, because they end up raising way more questions than
those of us. I want to know how they're counting models, because,
and what they're getting from this deal that they
probably
get from another.
Five, six, seven different models within the Golf lineup.
Right.
Is that what they're talking about?
But if they're all EVs, I mean, they're EVs.
I know, but to me, it's the Golf platform, and that's...
We'll see.
And then Mercedes announced that they're going to start selling more electric vehicles in China as well. And so is this test bed, or is this in order to address that market?
I think a little of both. But to Michelle's point, that's what the government's pushing. And China has the ability. First of all, they're building new infrastructure, but they also have the ability to rapidly change their infrastructure, just like they build these giant megacities out of nowhere. So they can say, we're doing electric and we're going to do it. It's like, I mean, if you think of Brazil and ethanol, but on a larger, more practical scale, that's what it is.
Yeah, do some of that sugar cane. So Michelle, I mean, what do you think about the viability of selling EVs in this market?
Well, it's not pretty now, is it? I mean, I just got a call from a reporter today or yesterday about Toyota Prius sales.
Down the drain.
And, you know,
still a decent number.
Oh,
though.
Totally. And still dominating the segment. But that segment is just
cratered.
And Nissan Leaf has huge incentives on it right now. So and it's not just gas prices, I don't think. I think there's still not the infrastructure. It's
will
not,
the Chevy Bolt EV change that?
It could. I mean, certainly the range is far better. The price point is good, and I understand the car itself is a good package. I don't see that it's going to be huge numbers. I think the play for the Bolt is to put it in the Lyft fleets and then go autonomous with that. I mean, that's where I see its future going.
But. So you don't see your next door neighbor coming home, Michelle, look at my new Bolt.
Maybe in California.
I think there's still the consumer perception and acceptance lags. You know, like people are willing to accept, okay, I really can get away with this, even as a second car. I mean, you look at Leaf incentives, used Leafs are dirt cheap. It's a really great second car, potentially. But people go, well, you know, I need a car. And some of it's a real practical concern. But the other, I think the big risk with the Bolt is everybody's rushing into EVs, and you know, gas prices are a factor, other things are a factor. There's this risk of flooding the market with a bunch of EVs that don't sell, and then, you know, sort of ruining the future
of
EVs.
So it becomes
EVs.
A stigma that, oh, it's got an electric, I don't think.
But here's the problem.
But you made a good point here, Mike. The resale value is nothing. So right. You might pull in 300,000 or whatever, you know, people to buy the Bolt and the Tesla Model 3. What if they have zero resale value or very poor resale value? What's that do to the market?
Right. And again, you know, from a company point of view, how do they make money on these? If you're subsidizing them like that, I mean, they're already getting some tax incentives, but where's the return on investment on those?
So Michelle, you mentioned autonomous vehicles, and also this week, Autoliv and Volvo said they're going to start a new company to develop autonomous technology, and they're going to have it available by 2019. And Volvo will use it, and Autoliv will sell it to other auto companies. Does this sort of really pound the stake in the ground and say autonomous vehicles are going to be here sooner rather than later? Okay. And maybe just in fleets?
I think they will be in fleets. I mean, I think this is going to be a long rollout of it'll be in fleets, it'll be in delivery vehicles, it'll be in specific settings, you know, where, what do they call it, geofencing or whatever. But, are we all going to have them in our driveway even in the next 10 years? I doubt it. But, you know, that's all anybody wants to talk about anymore is autonomous vehicles. And I think, you know, we're going to see those kinds of partnerships. You know, we're going to see some interesting bedfellows in some of these, and some will work and some will not.
So you're a big car guy. I'm sure they're going to have to peel your fingers off that steering wheel.
You know, I like the driver assistance we have now. And I've sort of just accepted, you know, the days of having a car that don't have these kind of systems on them are gone. We have to let that go. You know, both the automakers.
Except the analog brakes, finally.
I've always wanted or had those. But you know, it's just that's the way it's going. Like it, in terms of sales and what the companies are producing, and even just their incentive to say, hey, we have a shiny new toy, everything has it. But this Autoleave thing to me is just a, I don't think there's anything really remarkable about it because everyone's already working on these kind of partnerships and these kind of things. If you look at the assistance systems we have now, like adaptive cruise and lane keeping, those are essentially commoditized. We were looking at our shortlist for the Autoblog Technology of the Year Award, and we were like, hey, isn't there anything new in this autonomous drive stuff? And there's a little bit, but not really, because the suppliers have it, and they're selling it as components to all the automakers, and now everybody has the same thing. This Autoleave is going to be like that, and that's where we're going with autonomy, is it's just going to be a module that the product planners add in, and yeah, pretty quick.
What I find interesting is how many companies are getting into this. So you've got Volvo and Autoleave. You've got BMW, who's partnered with Intel, and I think it's
Mobileye.
You've got Ford going with Mobileye. No, with Velodyne and this neurological thing. Maybe Velodyne's part of that, too.
Mm-hmm.
Continental
Delphi.
Is trying. Delphi has got,
big,
you know, autonomy in a box.
Mm-hmm.
And Continental's forming its own consortium. I mean, going to be a lot of suppliers for autonomous systems
very
soon.
And to Mike's point, we could get to that whole commoditization of this. And then, again, you know, where's the value added on? And who's making the money?
So do you think it'll just be an option? You'll just go to your dealer and say, I want fully autonomous capability in my Malibu or my Fusion or my 200.
That's not how I see it going.
How do you see it?
Well, I think we're going to see more autonomous vehicles, and this is the Chevy Volt Maven kind of model, is that it'll be autonomous on demand. So you're at home and you want a ride somewhere and you belong to GM Maven Lyft, it's delivered to you when you need it or whatever kind of vehicle you wanted. That's how I see it in terms of the consumer.
Okay,
but I think that's far down the
road. So if it comes to my house, do I drive it or does it drive me?
It drives you.
Well,
you're fully autonomous is what we're talking about, right?
I suppose. Level 4 stuff or...
Yeah. Look, it is going to be an evolution,
mm-hmm.
and early on, they're going to be geofenced,
mm-hmm.
because you've got to be able to control the situation. They're not ready today. They're not going to be ready in 5 years to drive just anywhere.
No.
10 years, maybe you're getting to it in 10 years' time. But so, yeah, we're going to see this rollout with ever-increasing capabilities. And I've said this before, I think in the future, people will brag about, not my car's got more horsepower than yours, my car is more autonomous than yours, and it can deal with things like snow, and it can go and park in the field where we want to go watch the ball game and handle all that kind of stuff.
And in fact, we do this tech study every year, and every year we've seen the initial study we did, don't trust a car to, you know, there, it won't be safe to let it just drive by itself. We're seeing that soften. And also when we give people a list of different features that are driver-assisted features that go into autonomous cars, they go, yep, got to have that, check all the boxes. So, you know, we're learning more about it, getting more experience, more exposure, and the consumer acceptance will eventually be there, I think, increasing.
When do you see full autonomy?
Beyond 2020. I think the 2020 goal is going to be this sort of hands-free commute or hands-free in the city. And the path we're going on right now is, yeah, this is a high-level option package. You know, again, just think of it as an evolution of what we have now. The thing that's unknown for me is once we get to these cars that can drive themselves in limited situations, then it'll expand and we get more cars. Like, once we get to sort of a number of cars on the road, that critical mass, then we can start looking at how are we planning the way people drive and how are we planning the roads. And, you know, we're not there yet. And I think, and that's actually even kind of an interesting problem, because one of the key appeal of autonomous driving is, okay, you get some time back, or at least you take away the stress of driving. And that actually encourages people to keep driving their individual cars and not carpool and clog up all the lanes and keep buying new cars when, you know, the beauty of the car is a lot of the things that a lot of the problems today is not what's great about the car. You know, you don't want to sit in traffic. You want to be able to go wherever you want. And, the path we're going on now, until we look at the total transportation picture or infrastructure is not solving any of the problems we have with cars right now. It's just kind of giving you the time back inside the car.
See, but isn't it so, as you were talking earlier, Michelle, about the, you know, you dial up your Lyft and it mm-hmm. comes over and it's autonomous, and but then it goes and picks up Mike, and then it goes and picks up John, then it gets me, and then we all go downtown and do what we're doing, and then it just drives away and goes to pick somebody else up, which would solve your problem.
Yeah, well, but the other problem is, well, the other problem, though, is human nature, right? I mean, yeah, some people in cities, you know, or dense areas or who have extra time are going to want to do that. They'll do a rideshare. A lot of people are going, no, I have extra stuff in my car. I don't want to take it in and out every time.
I want to be alone.
I want to be alone. Yeah. I want to go straight to work. I want to go to the gym.
That's an extra fee on top of your... Okay.
Yeah, how do you tell the autonomous car that you want to stop off for coffee and then the other three people in your rideshare car outvote you?
Well, you know, look, there's going to be different price points, right? And so if we want to do
business models altogether.
Yeah, and so if the four of us want to get the cheapest ride possible, we'll carpool together in an autonomous car. But if I don't want to be around you guys at all, I'll pay a little bit more money.
Mm-hmm. And then maybe in our car, Starbucks will have this special thing that if we stop at a Starbucks, that we get a lower rate.
That's
no, you're
going
to be able to, if you're not driving, you're going to have your own little coffee maker.
There
you'll grind the beans.
Now you're pushing me back. You're pushing me back, Gary, to like, yes, give me the wheel. I want to drive.
Well, look, having gone from you guys saying there was no news to we've burned up the rest of the show talking about all the news going on in the industry. And with that, we got to wrap it up. But Mike, thanks so much for coming in.
Glad to be here.
And did you choose? What's your Autoblog Technology of the Year?
No, we haven't. We do the testing in October, so we're down to a short list.
Okay.
And yeah.
Well, you'll have to come back on and talk about that at a future date.
Yeah.
Michelle, great having you here.
Thanks.
And congratulations on your cinema debut.
Movie star.
Or not so
my
cinema.
Second. This
your
is my second.
Second. But yeah. I see a pattern here. I see a trend.
I never thought this would
you know, and the trend, if you think about that movie that we saw last night, I mean, Bob Lutz was a big star.
Yep.
He's been here several times.
Right.
Greg Gardner from the Detroit Free Press was in the movie. He's been here. I mean,
in fact, if you go down the list, I'll bet you 80% of the people in the movie have been in the studio.
See, that's where they got their break.
There you go.
Right. So, Gary, let's do this again next week.
Right.
I want to thank all of you for having tuned in.
AutoLine After Hours is brought to you by Bridgestone Tires, your journey, our passion. And by Lear, a global leader in automotive seating and electrical systems.
Visit our website, autoline.tv, where you can watch us live Thursday afternoons. Get your daily fix with AutoLine Daily and in-depth analysis and interviews with AutoLine This Week. There's all that and much more at autoline.tv.